Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. In September of 2015, Tom Mustel and his friend Charlotte went for an early morning kayak tour in Monterey Bay in California.
And we paddled out, and it was a dead, calm morning. It was beautiful. It was very misty, as it often is there. And there were sea lions and pelicans. And we paddled out just out of the harbor mouth of Moss Landing, which is a deep water harbor. And there were just dozens and dozens of humpback whales everywhere.
Tom is a wildlife filmmaker. He'd done films about whales before, but he had never seen so many of them this close to the shore. It was amazing, but also a little precarious. He knew you should always keep your distance from marine wildlife, but it seemed like the whales were coming closer and closer to them. So he and Charlotte tried to steer clear.
But here it was very difficult, because you couldn't see them until they suddenly came to the surface. They were engaged in really rapid feeding, where they'd just be coming up to catch breath before they'd disappear back under the water to hunt this big shoal of fish.
Tom's heart was racing. They decided to paddle back to shore.
When suddenly a whale just shot out of the water, very, very close to us, maybe kind of two whale lengths away. And it went up and up and up. And then we both realized that it was going to come down on us. And these are humpback whales, which are whales that frequently, compared to other species of whales, jump out of the water, and it's called breaching. And no one really knows why they do it. It could be for a lot of different reasons. But the important thing for me at that point in time wasn't why whales breach, but that this whale was going to land on us and we were going to die. It was very clear in my mind that we were going to die because there was no It was the same as if you were to be under a cliff and it was to fall on you. You know, there'd be no way that you'd think you could survive it.
Yeah, your friend Charlotte described it as if a building had grown out of the water. And I think we have to keep in mind that, you know, the whale is three times bigger than a T-Rex, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. I mean, can you imagine it?
No.
I feel like, yeah.
I mean, I still I can imagine it, but I can't imagine being underneath it.
It's unimaginable. I still think about it, and I can't get my head around it, because it's like as if gravity stopped or something. It was so big. And also, when it was very close, I think it was the details that made it real. You could see all the little scars and skeins of water coming off it and barnacles, and it just looked very fleshy and hard.
Then the giant whale came down on top of Tom, Charlotte, and the kayak.
And the next thing I remember, we were underwater and I was being thrown around all over the place. And we were pulled deeper underwater by the whale's body. And I remember, I still wasn't really scared at this point. It had all happened too quickly. But I started becoming scared once I realized I wasn't immediately dead, but I still thought that I probably had broken many of my limbs, or I was in shock and probably about to sort of die of whatever injuries I hadn't noticed yet. And it was all white underwater. I opened my eyes and the water was bright white from the impact of the whale, but I felt fine. And I could feel my life vest sort of tugging me upwards. So I swam to the surface. And I just remember coming out of the water and looking over, and Charlotte was already there. Her head was out of the surface and she was grinning, and she was absolutely fine. And so was I. And we just laughed.
They were flooded with adrenaline, stunned and happy to be alive. Tom's near-death encounter with the whale ignited a deep curiosity in him, and it sent him on a journey to really understand these creatures and their lives. On today's episode, a conversation with Tom Mustel about his new book, How to Speak Whale, A Voyage into the Future of Animal Communication. The kayak trip Tom took on that day in September was for fun, not for work, and he didn't get any of this incident on camera.
And I was mad with myself because I had two GoPros with me. I'm a wildlife filmmaker, and I left them in the car because, as I explained to Charlotte, everybody's whale film looks the same.
But somebody else had captured it, a guy on a whale watching boat nearby.
He knocked it over. He knocked it over, the kayak.
Tom watched the footage again and again. He wanted to understand what had happened. Why did the whale jump like that? And how did he and Charlotte survive? He started reaching out to some whale researchers he knew from previous documentary work.
Professor Joy Rydenberg at Mount Sinai is an expert in animal bodies. She is a comparative anatomist, and she's very good at looking at the bodies of different species and seeing how they move.
So Tom sent the footage to Joy, but he didn't mention that he was the guy on the kayak.
And I looked at it, and my first reaction to him was, what the expletive was that person doing so close to a whale? How stupid could they be?
Tom quickly filled Joy in, and he reassured her that they had only been watching the whales from afar, and this one just popped up out of nowhere. But the behavior of the whale still seemed weird to Joy.
So I started examining it frame by frame by frame, and as I was looking at it frame by frame by frame, over and over and over again, I noticed that the whale did something a bit unusual. It tried to rotate its breech while it was up in the air.
Joy says humpback whales usually land on the back of their head.
And this whale didn't. It actually rotated around and landed differently, you know, so that more of its chin and ventral or belly area was landing in the water, which is not the typical breech. And I thought, that's pretty odd. Why would it do that when it was clearly on a trajectory to arc and land backward on its head?
Here's her best guess. The whale tried to avoid the kayak.
And I think what happened was this whale saw the kayak and thought, holy expletive, I don't want to land on that. I don't know if it processed that there were people or that it was a kayak or anything. It was just like, oh, there's a thing in my way, and I didn't expect that. So the whale made an adjustment when it realized where its trajectory was taking it. And I thought that was very interesting because the whale cared about where it was landing. Now, whether it cared to save them or not, one can speculate. It's possible.
Tom Mustel says maybe the whale wanted to spare him and Charlotte out of some sense of empathy.
So there is evidence for what you would call in humans altruism in humpback whales.
But
most likely there was a hungry whale really enjoying feeding, doing a big jump to maybe show off or attract the attention of some other whales nearby. And it looked down and suddenly, there was some really unpleasant looking object with some squishy people in it.
And what's your favorite version of that story? If you could pick one to be true, what would you like the whale to have thought?
I would like the whale to have looked at me and thought, I'm not going to squish you, silly human, but in exchange, you need to write a book about how great we are.
The video of Tom, Charlotte, and the whale quickly became a viral sensation. Tom did lots of interviews about what happened, and he became determined to learn more about whales and really get to understand their behavior.
So I went back to Monterey Bay and I just started interviewing lots and lots of different people, people who rescue whales when they get tangled in nets, people who paint whales, people who go whale watching, scientists who put tags on their backs.
And he discovered that technology was fundamentally changing how scientists were observing these animals.
Because we have all these robots and all the scientists, and there were drones flying over them. There were tags and video recorders on their backs. There were microphones on the seabed.
All of this information was being gathered and analyzed, bringing new insights. For example, there are better ways to track individual whales.
You can identify whales and see who's who, because each whale has a tail fluke. which is like a fingerprint. So the fluke of the whale is the big kind of paddle at the end of its caudal peduncle, which is the big muscular kind of tail. And humpback whales, especially when they dive, this sticks up out of the water. And so if you're on a whale watching trip, that's when everyone goes, ooh, and then you hear the sound of all of their cameras as they take lots of pictures. And so in a whale, that's a bit like a whale showing you its personal flag, because each tail is different. And some have got tooth marks from killer whales that tried to eat them when they were babies, or scars from barnacles, or different pigmentation patterns, or cuts from being hit by boat propellers or getting caught in fishing nets, or just natural variations in shape and size. And so from comparing the tails, you can start to piece together the lives of these creatures. And for a long time, this work was done by dedicated scientists, and really, really hardcore whale watchers, mostly the captains and people who are really into it. But there was this guy called Ted Cheeseman, who just happened to be exactly where the whale had landed on me. He lives in Santa Cruz, and he'd launched a website called Happy Whale, where tourists could upload all their whale tail photographs. And because he realized that around the world, every day, hundreds of boats go out with thousands of tourists gathering really valuable scientific data. And he thought, well, if I just make a website where people can put it, maybe we can start putting that together. And he started that 2 weeks before the whale jumped onto us. So he had uploads of hundreds of photographs just from that day. And he used that to find out who the whale was that jumped onto us. And this was mind-blowing to me. And not only did he find out who it was, he was able to compare that with other sightings and tell me that it was 7 years old, that it was born in Central America. He could tell me who its mother was. He could show me other times where it had appeared. And I could then follow it on the website and get automatic updates every time somebody else has seen it. And it's since popped up a few times. So as far as we know, this whale, which is now nicknamed Prime Suspect, is alive and well. After Ted had identified the whale that jumped onto me, he told me that they'd done it using artificial intelligence, that they'd shifted over from using expert humans to notice the patterns on whales' tails and match them to specially trained machines. And that is the kind of rabbit hole I went down into, or the thread that I chased.
Tom told me about one of the pioneers in the field, a biologist named Roger Payne, who was one of the first people to try to understand how whales communicate. Roger got interested in whales in the late 60s, during a time when many whale species were disappearing rapidly.
We didn't care enough about whales at this point to stop them from going extinct. We were hunting them so intensely and so industrially that in some places, 99% of the entire populations had been wiped out.
Then Roger was invited to listen to some strange recordings captured by underwater microphones at a hydrophone station off the coast of Bermuda.
Beautiful, complicated, long calls. And Roger was spellbound. They were so beautiful.
Roger suspected these sounds were made by whales.
And he started realizing there were repeating patterns within them. He did more work and managed to link them to humpback whales to prove that they were whales making these sounds.
And he decided that the world had to hear this. In 1970, he produced and released an album called Songs of the Humpback Whale.
And it was what we'd call now a viral hit. It was everywhere. It was on all the TV shows, musicians, people played it in churches, people got together to have whale song listening parties. His friend Carl Sagan put it on the Voyager space probes and it blasted into space along with messages to aliens. It was everywhere. And it was critical because it changed how we saw the whales. We suddenly thought, well, if they can sing, maybe we shouldn't be killing all of them.
And did people venture a guess why the whales were singing? What was the purpose of their song?
Absolutely. There were loads of theories. And ultimately, we still don't really know. The main theory is that it's like other displays of males in the natural world, that it's a sexual selection. It's a way of showing off and trying to get the females to mate with you.
But Tom Mustell thinks there's more to whale song than mating.
They have enormously sensitive ears. They have an incredible range of sounds. And they have really big brains. And so that's the hardware that you need. If you want to have a conversation, it needs to be useful for your life. And it is really useful if you need to coordinate living in a dangerous, dark environment where you need to team up with other organisms. You need to have a brain that can compute sound and conceive of the idea of others and how your communications might impact them and to take their information on board. And you need to be able to hear it and you need to be able to make it yourself. And they have top marks in every class of this. So these are really, really encouraging signs that the sounds we're hearing from these species might be sophisticated communication.
So we still don't quite know why whales sing, why these repeated patterns, what they are communicating. But we have so many new tools in terms of capturing this communication. So What did you discover in that realm?
This is particularly exciting because in the sea, we're very limited because most of the time you're stood on a boat waiting for them to come up to breathe. Imagine if all you knew about lions, you learned every time they breathed, but otherwise suddenly just the screen went blank. You know, so we've had these flashes of really basic information is unknown. I mean, some species have never even been seen. We've just heard them. But now we have machines that can perceive, they can hear frequencies of sound that we can't. And whales make use of low frequencies that are below our hearing and higher frequencies above them. So we can hear their full range of communications. We can leave recording devices on the seabed permanently. We can leave them floating. We can fly drones above whales that can look down through the water column and see their interactions as groups really clearly. You can't see looking down close to the surface on a boat. We can put cameras on their bodies and see their lives from their perspectives. And you have robots that can sail their way across entire oceans, recording the lives of whales and dolphins as they go. So really, we have a sort of superhuman period now of being able to spy on whales.
And what are we learning? What are we now hearing and seeing that we could never hear and see before?
I guess in general terms, we're learning that they're very complicated, that many of the species are highly social and that they live long. I mean, some whales can live for over 150 years, that they survive by coordinating their behavior, teaching each other how to live and navigate and survive in the sea, defend themselves against predators together. They care for their old and their sick, and they take care of each other's young, some species in creches. When I'm making these generalizations and I say they, these are normally examples found from one species. So it doesn't mean that they all do them. We just don't really know what most whales do. We find that some of them have friends, as in they make associations with other unrelated whales and they travel for hundreds and hundreds of miles with them. They seem to hunt in teams with different roles, communicating with each other while they do that, like humpback whales making nets of bubbles. Other species seem to have names or what we'd call signature whistles. They have clans, like groups of whales, this is sperm whales, that differentiate from one another by the sounds, their accents that they make, their vocalizations. And they have what we call cultures. They have ways of living that they learn and teach one another that are vital for their survival that differ massively between different social groups. So what we're really discovering is a sort of golden age of complexity and social life and evolution in the sea.
That's nature filmmaker Tom Mustell. We're talking about his new book, How to Speak Whale. What's going on in the minds of whales? One of the scientists Tom profiles in his book is trying to learn more about that. Joy Rydenberg is a professor of anatomy at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York City. She spent most of her career studying whales, which includes dolphins and porpoises.
What most people don't know is that dolphins actually are whales. So when you think of a dolphin, you really need to think of it as a very tiny whale. because it essentially is doing all the things other whales do and is related to all of them. It's just a small cousin.
And she says smaller whales, like dolphins, are key to studying the big ones.
We fondly call our dolphins in the scientific world the white lab mice of the dolphin world because these are the ones that are accessible for experimental work. If you wanted to study their behavior, for example, or understand more about their physiology, you can do that with animals that are in captivity, and these are the ones that are most readily available. We know most of the things that we know from dolphins, and we apply that and scale it up to the bigger animals.
Now, one of the areas of interest with whales is obviously their behavior and how they, I guess, think and how much intelligence they have. What have people like you been able to learn about that?
It's really hard to know how intelligent an animal is because the tests that we want to use are tests that we think of that are good for people. So some things can apply and translate easily, and some things just don't apply because they don't think or behave in the ways that we expect, and so their organization of their brain is totally different from ours. That doesn't mean that they're not smart, but it's just not an appropriate test. And so you have to adjust the test to what the animal can process, first of all, to be able to assess anything. But one of the best tests that I know is out there about how smart they are is that they can recognize that what they're looking at in a mirror is an image of themselves and not another animal. And that seems to be something that only animals on a very high level of intelligence can easily figure out. Even human children, when they're very, very young, don't figure it out. They look into a mirror and they think it's another baby there. And it takes a little while before they get to the point where they recognize that it is themselves. And dolphins can figure that out pretty quickly. So we know that there's already that level of intelligence called mirror recognition. And we see it in dolphins, we see it in elephants, we see it in great apes, and of course we see it in humans.
And how does the dolphin know what it looks like? I mean, if the dolphin sees itself in the mirror, recognizes that that's me, but how do they know that, oh, that's my image?
You know, that's a really interesting question. How do they know it's their own image and not some other animal? I think it's a combination of two things. One is, I think that they are able to very quickly figure out that the animal in the mirror is paralleling their actions. And so as it nods its head, the one in the mirror is doing exactly the same thing at exactly the same time. And that monkey see, monkey do behavior, as we've often called it, is something that is not recognized by other animals as being initiated by themselves. But the animal does recognize that they are initiating the action and the reflection is doing the same thing. Eventually, you can figure it out if they're smart enough that that's a reflection of themselves. But I think dolphins have an additional advantage, and it's probably true of most of the whales. And that is that they live in an aquatic environment to begin with. And that aquatic environment has a mirror built into it at the surface of the water. So as they look up at the surface of the water, as they're about to break through it to breathe, they can often see a reflection of themselves in the water. So that mirror is already a familiar thing to them because they grow up seeing themselves in the water. But being able to see themselves better without wrinkles from the waves and other stuff like that, I think fascinates them. So when they're given an opportunity to see a mirror, they're like, wow, I really want to see what the inside of my mouth looks like because I've never been able to do that before. Or what's underneath, you know, my flipper? What's on my back? You know, and they start twisting around and doing all these really interesting things to see different parts of their body that they wouldn't normally be able to see without the mirror.
And they also figured out how they could use that tool that they just discovered.
Absolutely, yes. It became a tool for them.
Yeah, that's another big step.
Yeah, and they use other things in their environment also to their advantage as tools. So tool using, we often associate that with higher intelligence. It's actually pretty widespread among many animals. I mean, you see crows, for example, using tools. And we certainly know primates do it. There are lots of animals that use tools. But in the case of whales, there aren't a lot of objects that they can use in when you're swimming around in water. What are you going to use? So they've figured out how to make tools out of their everyday bodily functions. So whales, like humpback whales, use air as a tool. They can corral fish using air. Dolphins in particular have gone one step further because they're in much shallower waters, and they can actually kick up mud and cause the same kind of corral to corral fish by just making little mud pockets all the way around the school of fish by beating their tail into the sand or the mud. So that they use that tool. I've seen pictures of dolphins taking sponges and putting it over the tip of their snout so that it's like having a glove, so they can then poke their snout in between pieces of rocks or coral and not scrape themselves up as they chase fish out.
A big part of Joy's job is to examine whales that have died. That includes giant ones that may be washed ashore somewhere. Dissect their bodies, look at their organs, and determine what sort of life they lived. It's challenging work, and not for the faint of heart.
I think of this really as a very messy construction zone, because many times I'm wearing a hard hat and chainmail gloves and big steel-lined boots. I'm working around cables or chains. I've got heavy equipment everywhere, you know, backhoes and front-end loaders and maybe a flatbed truck to take the whale to a weigh station on the highway to get a weight. I mean, it's just an incredible, complicated activity because you depend so much on heavy equipment to move these animals around.
And then Joy has to get inside of the whale to dissect it.
You're literally stepping into the area that you're trying to work on as you're working. And I often get pretty well engulfed into a whale as I work. I might wear something like fisherman's chest waders because I'm really literally that deep in whale guts as I'm mucking my way around through its body trying to find different organs and see what's going on.
But when it comes to studying the actual brain of a whale, that opportunity is hard to come by.
So the brain is one of the first tissues to decompose when you've got a dead animal. It rots very, very, very quickly. So if you don't get to it in the first 24 hours or less, it's really not a valuable organ to study anymore because it just turns into, you know, liquefied jello. So we don't and won't hunt whales in this country. So how do you get a fresh brain? You have to be able to get to the site where the stranded animal is within 24 hours and be able to get access to that brain. So getting there is probably the easier part of the job. Getting access is very difficult. So strandings are run through the National Marine Mammal Health and Stranding Response Network. Their first job is the task of finding out why the animal died. Research specimens are always a second priority. So getting a brain is in conflict with most of the autopsy procedure that goes on. And so we have to respect that there are needs other than our research needs and let those needs come first. And if there's time, we can get into the brain.
But you had the opportunity to look at a whale brain.
Yes, I have.
All the stars must have aligned. But what did you learn?
So there are a lot of things you can learn from looking at whale brains. One is that the organization of the brain is very different from ours. A lot of the brain is dedicated to understanding the spatial environment that they live in. And the processing, how they process things through the brain is very different from us.
I asked Joy about new technologies that are changing how whale research is done. And she mentioned drones that are equipped with cameras, which offer a lot of insight into whale behavior without disturbing them.
Most whales don't pay attention to these drones because they don't hear them, because their hearing is really in the water, not in the air. So they don't hear that buzzing sound, which is great because you can follow these whales from above and see what's going on. Not only can you watch their behavior, but you can assess their health status. You can see how skinny they are or how fat they are, they're starving. You can see injuries on them. We're now working with a team that's trying to do thermal imaging of the whales to see where scars are on the body, where they're losing excessive heat because they've lost the protective layer of insulation, or to measure their temperature by looking at the thermal image of the inside of the blowhole. It's kind of like putting a thermometer in without actually putting a thermometer in and taking its temperature to see what its core body temperature is and get an assessment of, is this animal running a fever? Is this animal too cold? And so on. And I think this is a really new, exciting development, not only for understanding behavior, but starting to monitor aspects of their physiology to assess health status of these animals.
What are you just dying to find out? It seems like a lot of times there is so much research that you would like to do that's really hard to do. The possibilities are somewhat limited. So if you could, what would you just love to know?
That's such a pipe dream. If I could, what would I love to know? You know, we as humans try not to interfere that much with a wild animal's behaviors, especially if they're an endangered species. And we have setback rules where we're not allowed to approach a whale within about 200 yards, you know, give or take, depending on the region of the world you're in. And if you just put your boat in idle, sometimes the whales or the dolphins come to you, in which case that's fine. It's on their own terms. What I'd really love to know is when they're on a people watch, why are they so curious about us? And what do they think we are when they look up at a boat and they see people on a boat? Do they want to interact with us? Do they desire that interaction? Are they curious about us? I'd love to know what they're thinking about us, because I think they want to be on people watches as much as we want to be on whale watches.
That's Joy Rydenberg. She is a professor of anatomy at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York City. We're talking about whales and what scientists are learning about them. Joy mentioned how much researchers rely on dolphins to study whales in general. And I talked to a researcher who spends a lot of time observing dolphins. Justin Gregg is a senior research associate with the Dolphin Communication Project.
We study communication between dolphins. So both audio information that we record, so their clicks and whistles, but also tactile information, so how they touch each other and then posture. So any form of communication between dolphins.
And how do you study that? How do you keep track of them?
We have an underwater camera with audio attached to it, so we can jump in the water with the dolphins, usually snorkeling, and you just follow them around with the camera and the recording equipment and hopefully record them going about their everyday lives and acting as natural as possible, and then going back into the, you know, office and looking at what you've recorded and analyzing it.
And what have you learned so far? What are some of the things that have perhaps surprised you?
The complexity of their social systems is quite fascinating. So when you're studying dolphins communicating, it's not just, you know, how they do it, but why they're doing it. And usually it has to do with the complexity of the social system. So why would this juvenile be contacting this adult male right now? Or how often do you see tactile communication between two subadult females? And so to understand communication, you really need to understand the complexity of dolphin social interactions. And that's what makes it quite fascinating and difficult to study.
And what have you observed? How do they interact with each other? Is there a hierarchy of sorts, or what's going on?
Yeah, not with most dolphin species people are familiar with. They don't live in a hierarchical society. They live in a similar enough system to the human system. So we call them fission-fusion groups. So you'll have a small group of friends that will get together, and then a few hours later, they'll split off and join a different group. So you always have these coming and goings of small social groups. There's no single leader, and there's no, you know, the omega at the bottom of the pack. It's not like that. It's just strengths of friendships that you see.
When you record the dolphins communicating, how do you analyze those recordings to detect patterns?
Yeah, you have all sorts of software that can automatically extract information. We sort of have done it always the old-fashioned way. You just sort of look and listen and try and match up whistle sounds to the specific dolphin that had made it. And so you try and figure out who's making what sound and in what circumstance and what might the goal be of it. Well, you know, thousands of hours of recordings. So it sounds very glamorous, I have to say, to go swimming with dolphins and recording them. But probably 90% of the time, you're just staring at a screen, looking at an audio waveform and trying to figure out what's going on. So less glamorous, but completely necessary.
And when you listen to it, to our human ears, does a lot of it sound the same, or can you hear differences?
Yeah, wow, that's a good question, because the dolphin auditory system and the human system aren't the same. However, we have enough in common in terms of the frequencies that we can hear that to our ears, and the dolphin ears, they might sound quite similar. Of course, they're listening to it underwater, where sound travels much, much faster. So their whole auditory system is made to deal with that speed difference. And also, they can produce frequencies that are much higher than humans can hear. So we have to have equipment that can both record and analyze those super high frequencies that are outside of our hearing. But if you're swimming with dolphins, your head is underwater, you'll hear them making a lot of noise. They're very loud.
Here are some sounds Justin sent us from his lab. Justin says dolphin whistles are similar to human whistles, but he especially likes a different sound they make.
The more interesting sound for me, anyway, is the click sounds. So they make a bunch of click sounds that sound like creaking doors sometimes, like if you slowly open a creaking door. And some of those are used for social communication, these buzzing sounds. And a lot of that is used for echolocation. So that's not for communication, but for like bat sonar, so that they can learn information about the world by bouncing sound waves off of things.
Have you gotten a sense of what they are communicating? Are there mundane things that seem to be more like a, hey, what's up? Or, you know, what are they saying?
Yeah, a lot of it would be your sort of standard animal communication stuff. So they'd be communicating when they're excited or when they're upset. There are certain sounds that come out. That's sort of standard to everything. But what makes dolphins quite interesting, and we know from studying them in the lab, is that they can learn labels for things. Like you can teach them artificial symbol systems and teach them the words connect to certain activities or ideas. And so the goal has always been like, well, do they have a system of their own that functions like that?
The dolphins you study, they are in some sort of captivity in a basin?
Our research group has studied in a number of areas. I researched wild dolphins in Japan for my PhD. So those are just wild dolphins swimming around an island. We have a research area in the Bahamas, and those are also wild spotted dolphins. And then there's also a captive facility in Honduras that we visit as well. So the group is keen to study all the differences between captive and wild and just the different species in different locations to see what's different about the way they communicate in different environments.
That's Justin Gregg. He's a researcher with the Dolphin Communication Project. He's also a science writer and author. His latest book is called If Nietzsche Were a Narwhal. Justin says he's really looking forward to new findings and insights now that AI is becoming more prevalent in interpreting the dolphin sounds that they capture.
The AI out there seems to be very good at just making connections, and AI might be able to make a connection that we would never even think to look for, and that's when you make discoveries.
And that's what we'll talk about next, how AI is moving the needle in terms of understanding animal communication.
What the promise of this is that you can find the pattern of a whole language, of all the relationships between the units within it, and you can make a sort of star chart of a kind of galaxy.
That's still to come on The Pulse.
The Commonwealth Fund supports The Pulse and reporting on health equity. The Commonwealth Fund, affordable quality healthcare for everyone.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about whales with nature filmmaker Tom Mustel. His new book, How to Speak Whale, features some of the most cutting-edge research into whales and their behavior, like artificial intelligence being used to identify and track individual animals. But the book starts off in a very unexpected place, the workshop of a 17th century merchant in the Netherlands.
Anthony van Leeuwenhoek, who lived about, I guess it's 400 years ago almost, in Delft.
Van Leeuwenhoek was a draper who was curious, driven, and clever, and he started making his own magnifying glasses to better inspect the quality of the cloth he was using.
He made tiny, tiny, tiny pinhead-sized glass spheres, and he mounted them on a piece of metal, and he stuck that right next to what he wanted to look at and squinted through the light at it.
Now he could see the weave of the different fabrics in great detail, small imperfections that had previously been invisible to him. And soon he started to investigate the world around him.
And one of the things he looked at was some pond water. And in that pond water, he discovered life.
He saw tiny organisms that were usually invisible to the human eye.
He found life in water from the insides of your mouth, intestinal water from pigs and dogs, in dirt, in dust, everywhere. It turned out it was swarming with other living creatures.
And his findings were met with this kind of incredulous reaction. Like, there are little animals everywhere. Like, please. Like, people didn't quite buy it.
100%. There were a couple of things that made it hard for other people to get their heads around this. Like, one of them was that the theory of the time was that there was nothing there. For example, there was a theory called spontaneous generation, which held that rather than fleas and eels coming from like tiny little eggs that we couldn't see, they just kind of burst into existence from sort of dust and dew.
Discovering this previously unseen world ushered in a whole new way of understanding life on Earth.
Well, I just think it's a wonderful story about how unexpected people can find things that have always been in front of us, that once they show them to us, they change the way we look at the world around us forever.
And the reason Tom decided to start his book with this story is that he believes we're on the cusp of opening yet another window into a previously hidden world, into the minds of whales and animal communication.
As we bring new tools to bear that help us see things that we weren't able to see before, the behaviors and communications of other species, we might be coming towards a place where we could decode the communications of other species and seek to interact with them meaningfully.
What is the promise of artificial intelligence in terms of perhaps allowing us to interpret what we're capturing, the sounds, the songs of whales? I think at some point in your book, you call it the Google Translate for,
yes,
for whale speak.
Google Translate doesn't translate like you and I do. We're taught to learn different languages by being given rules. The way that Google Translate works now, or one of the tools that's part of Google Translate, is that, and this is a big simplification, but essentially some researchers discovered that you can map language. So you can start to ask a computer algorithm to organize and find patterns in that language based on the relationships between the words and how often they come up. You know, so there are relationships between king and queen and boy and girl, and you can map these relationships. But what the promise of this is that you can find the pattern of a whole language, of all the relationships between the units within it. And you can make a sort of star chart of a kind of galaxy. And then the really exciting thing is that if you compare the shape of that entire language with the shape of another entire language with its star chart, you can sort of move them around until they match up, because the word in one place with the similar relationships to the word in the same place in a different map with similar relationships will tend to be fulfilling the same function. So without using a dictionary, without teaching the software how to speak, it can intuit from similar patterns within languages, what word is the same in a different language.
Is there any concern that, you know, artificial intelligence is obviously created by humans, and we can only think of language in the way that we know language? So we're sort of applying our human lens to this interpretation of language. But then if we're trying to listen to other animals, is there any concern that maybe we just have it all wrong in terms of, you know, what we think of as language is so different?
I think actually it's the opposite. I think these technologies allow us to remove our human lens of language in a way, because we're stuck with our idea of what language is, and we define it as just what we do, and we're the only ones who really properly do it. We can't really imagine other languages very easily. And so the ways we've tried to find meaning in other species or find out whether they have the capacity for language is by teaching them how to speak like us. You know, if a seal can't speak English, it doesn't mean that a seal can't have language. Or we try and teach them other ways of communicating, or we try and find some way of understanding the sounds that seals make. But if we only can see little tiny bits of their lives, it's very hard to find a way in and to test whether our theories about whether there is some communication or language-like capacity there present. But these techniques allow us to do a top-down approach. They allow us to start mapping it. And that's why I make the comparison with Anthony van Leeuwenhoek. He didn't know what he was looking at. He invented a tool that allowed him to see what was there.
Ends his book with a look toward the future, a passage written for his daughter, who is 18 months old. I asked him to read it.
I'll have to try not to cry. Okay. Yeah, this is an emotional bit. Okay. My daughter will surely grow, and I will surely age. And whether it is from another leaping well falling on me, or I trip on the stairs, I will die. And she will have to learn what it means to lose something forever. This is inevitable, but there are losses we do not have to learn to accept, which we can choose to stop. The fates of the whales and dolphins is in human hands, and this loss is one I do not want for her. I hope that when she looks at the sea, an aged woman, she will catch a glimpse of a leaping spinner dolphin or humpback whale. And perhaps when she sticks her head beneath the waves, and hears their whistles and songs, as I did, they will mean something to her. And perhaps, just perhaps, she will be able to answer back. I am here, she would say. You are here, and I am here.
Mustel is a filmmaker and author. His new book is called How to Speak Whale, A Voyage into the Future of Animal Communication. As for the whale that jumped on Tom, nicknamed Prime Suspect, Tom still follows him on the tracking site called Happy Whale.
So he was last seen in California in 2020 in October, 2nd of October.
And Tom's hopeful he'll pop up again soon. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, and Jad Slayman. Marcus Biddle is our health equity fellow. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, and this week we had additional engineering from Al Banks. Nicole Curry is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.